Sometimes I start to chuckle because columns make me laugh. But this is something different. You've never dabbled in verse until now, have you?
No. And of course, I don't write anything in this book either. This is other people's writings. I don't have the gift of verse. I think it's a special talent to be able to write that kind of thing.
Well, you have the gift of liking it, though, and I think that's important because a lot of people don't.
Yeah, I can't understand why anybody doesn't. I know why, people don't like, they think they don't like poetry because they've got out of the habit of reading poetry or listening to it. But many places in the world, poetry reading has come back, hasn't it? People read it aloud to large audiences. In America, somehow, we've lost poetry. Why is that? I don't know.
Well, because poetry sometimes is very inaccessible to people. And if you're dealing with the academic poets, people like John Ashbery and people like even Robert Lowell and others, Robert Duncan, these poets are very difficult to follow. And sometimes you have to have academics write treatises about these books and read them in order to understand what the poet is talking about. But a little different with regard to your collection of light verse, because these are very accessible poems. You can read them and understand exactly what's being said to you, and they bring back, well, I noticed one, Burma Shave. Now, when I was a kid in Illinois and Kansas, Missouri, and my father would drive on the highway, and we would see these Burma Shave signs, we would all holler them out as we pass these signs. This is a wonderful thing to bring back. So the light verse brings back a sense of nostalgia and a sense of understanding, too, about the various things that the poet wants to tell us.
Yes, I remember those signs very well. Back in the 30s, they were all along the side of the road, and they always came in five installments. They were posted at intervals, so you could, as you read one and moved on, the next one was coming up, and you read them off automatically, and some of them were delightful. There's one in there that I came across. Ben met Anna, made a hit, neglected whiskers, Ben Anna split. Well, Burma Shave, they always ended with Burma Shave. It's an ad for shaving cream, right? But that's the most, it's a marvelously economical example of how much you can say with few words in English. Banana split.
I have to say, though, in my youth, sometimes I didn't understand the Burma Shave.
What was the Burma Shave?
A little too complicated for me. Then another thing you've done here, too, some of the verse isn't really verse. Well, I guess it is, but here you have a lot of Noel Coward's lyrics.
Yes. Well, Noel Coward comes close to being verse. I wanted to get song lyrics into this collection, because it seems to me that we don't write light verse very successfully anymore, for whatever reason. Not much is written, except, I thought, possibly song lyrics. And I went through a lot of song lyrics, people like Lawrence Hart, people that I admire, and Hammerstein, Rodgers and Hammerstein. And I found very few of those lyrics, clever as they are when they're set to music, very few of them hold up on the printed page, come off as amusing verse. You have to hear the music in your head. Noel Coward was the exception. Noel Coward, I thought, you didn't need to know the music to enjoy those verses. As a matter of fact, I've got some Noel Cowards in there that I don't know the music to. But I think the answer to that, the explanation, is that Noel Coward probably wrote verse first and then set it to his music. I think that's what often happened with him. Whereas most song lyricists, they think of music, they think musically. I suspect that's what happened. I can't explain it.
Isn't there a difference between verse and poetry?
No, I don't know what the difference would be. I wouldn't want to have to defend that. The notion, what we're getting back to here is the thing of poetry being inaccessible. The people you mentioned before, Robert Lowell, John Ashbery, perhaps John Berryman, Delmore Schwartz, this whole group of people who were the post-war poets and were, I thought, fearfully inaccessible. And poetry, in a way, became synonymous with inaccessibility. I don't see why it should be. I mean, Shakespeare is certainly in a class with any of those, and he's completely accessible.
Well, there are people who say the doggerel, for example,
doggerel.
Is certainly verse, but
oh yes, well,
people will say, well, that's certainly not poetry.
Oh yes, well, of course. I mean, but we're, you know, we're such a grading people. We have to categorize everything. Why isn't it poetry? Bad poetry. It's bad poetry.
But there's nothing wrong with bad poetry. Did I see?
It might be offensive to aesthetically. It might be offensive. There's a poem in there by a man named McGonagall, who's always billed as the world's worst poet. And he had one poem, and it's true, this stuff is just dreadful. He wrote in the middle of the 19th century, and he had one that was so awful, I thought, it has to be included. And it's four lines, and I think I can recite it from memory. It goes, the hen it is a noble beast. The cow is more forlorner. Standing in the rain with a leg at every corner. Now, that was his verse or
that was
poem,
probably his best poem.
I thought, that's so awful, it's wonderful.
Well, the one you have the purple cow in here, don't you?
Yes, the Gillette Burgess, yes.
When I remember when I was a kid. That's not the greatest poem in the world, but I never saw a purple cow.
That's a bit of understatement.
But I can tell you anyhow, I'd rather see than be one. Now, that's not the greatest poem in the world, and yet I like it so much because my mother used to tell that poem to me, recite that poem to me over and over again when I was a kid.
Why does it stay with us? No, it's not a great poem. Why do we, you know, here we are deciding, you know, we're grading papers again, aren't we?
Well, you mentioned this was a bad... The McGonagall, that is his name?
McGonagall. William McGonagall.
Well, he's
world's
recited
worst
a bad poem. And yes, I guess in terms of academic criticism, it's a bad poem, and yet it makes us laugh. It tells us something. It's funny. Yeah. He probably didn't mean it that way, but still. you don't have... Did you have any... I can't remember. Did you have any doggerel, like the boy stood on the burning deck?
I left that out.
Oh.
I left out the Casey at the bat. I left out the shooting of Dan McGrew there.
That's because they were boring to type.
Yes, that's true, yes. My daughter, who assisted nobly, I should say, her ear for poetry is perhaps better than mine, she pleaded with me not to have Casey at the bat, and didn't have to plead very much. She said she couldn't bear to type it, and I realized I couldn't bear to read it again, so we left that out. I wanted to keep pieces essentially short, and even then I have some rather long pieces.
Well, how did you go about collecting all these poems? Did you just squirrel them away as you came across them over a period of time?
I worked with my daughter, and we worked for about a year and a half collecting material. It's not easy finding this stuff. You know, if somebody comes to you and says, well, let's put together a volume of light verse, you think, oh, that's fun, because then you immediately think of five or six limericks that you know and a couple of Lewis Carrolls and some Lear. And you've got seven or eight pieces. Well, that doesn't make a book. You need 400 or 500 pieces. And you suddenly realize that you're going to have to go back into a lot of old 19th century books and try to find stuff. So it was an enormous piece of research, really. You know, and I discovered, I can put in a plug for the Strand Bookshop here in New York. I found I just looted the poetry section down there. It was full of these wonderful old poetry books published in 1910, 1890, and whatnot. And we just, you know, was reading through those dust and cobwebs.
Well, you certainly have a cross-section of poets, including people like... Marge Piercy, modern poets, John Updike, modern people, as well as... Well, here's a very famous poet that I've read his stuff over the years. It's called Anonymous.
Yes.
That's a Greek...
he's
Greek
a busy, poet. Busy fellow. You wonder when he sleeps.
Well, tell me how you...
I discovered something about Anonymous, if I may, that... A lot of Anonymous's work is written by poets who have some reputation, but because they regard the work as frivolous or inferior, they won't have their name attached to it. So if you look through some of these Mr. Anonymous's poems, some of them you say, well, gee, you know, anybody who spent that much time on a verse must be known, but he doesn't want his name attached to it.
So it becomes a pen name.
Yeah. Those things don't just spring. They don't grow in the fields out there.
Now, Bermashay, written by Anonymous. Now, you would have thought they would have had a big advertising agency or something doing all the Burma shave signs, but it turns out to be anonymous.
It's a mystery who did the Burma shave signs, actually.
Well, tell me how you decided to organize. Once you collected all of these hundreds and hundreds of poems, how did you organize them?
Well, I wanted to avoid the usual chronological organization. I don't know. You went to college. Everybody's been to college now, whether they learned anything or not. I went to college, didn't learn much. But the first thing that happens when you go to college, you're loaded down with anthologies. And they always start back there with the Beowulf. And then you go to Pierce Plowman. And you do Edmund Spenser. And then you've done Chaucer, Spenser, Shakespeare. You go through it chronologically. And that chronological progression of literature to me is always sophomore English. And it reminds me of exceedingly boring days in my youth. So I thought I want to avoid that, this kind of chalky, musty old school smell on the stuff. So I'll do it according to subject matter. It's not a particularly original idea to do it that way. But it did allow me to break out of the chronological mold so that I didn't have to start off with Chaucer and Shakespeare. I could, put contemporary poets up against metaphysical poets from the 17th century.
Oh, it's handy. It's a handy organization. It's kind of like Bartlett's Book of Quotations.
You know? I've never solved Bartlett's Book of Quotations.
I think you're also right about the literature you had to read as a sophomore, especially in high school. Shakespeare did turn out to be the bane for many high school graduates who have loathed Shakespeare, unfortunately, ever since. Of course, there is one good thing to say about Shakespeare. He only wrote the one book, the collected
works of Shakespeare.
So it's not like having to read a whole bunch of Shakespeare books.
This is an ancient grievance of mine, is the way schools teach literature. It always seemed to me that they present children with classics that children are not prepared to understand because they don't have the experience of life necessary to understanding it. And I don't think any ninth grader has experience of life prepared that prepares him to enjoy Shakespeare. So he has to rely on some teacher to say, this is marvelous.
And well, I'm all set now that I've almost reached my dotage to go back and read The Merchant of Venice. I can hardly wait to do that. Silas Latham, all these wonderful books.
Did you read them in school?
Well, I was assigned those books to read in school.
Exactly.
Now, I can't remember them, but...
I was assigned to read Moby Dick somewhere in school.
That was a tough one, though, wasn't it?
Oh, wow. Well, of course, I never got it read. And then I went to college, and I was assigned to read it again because I had an English professor who was one of the world's great Melville experts. And I did read it. I labored through the whole thing. And when I was 40 years old, my 40th year... I happen to be in Nantucket, where Moby Dick starts, I guess. It's the home, spiritual home of Moby Dick in a way. Anyhow, and I got the book and I started reading. And I suddenly realized this is a fantastic book. And why had I hated it before? And I realized because I was 40 years old and I was ready for Moby Dick. Because I think until you realize that you are mortal, you can't understand Ahab, what he has against that whale. And then once you realize, once you come to grips with the fact that you're mortal and are going to die, then yeah, you can understand Ahab's fury at the whale. The child is not prepared for that.
Also, it turned out to be true that Moby Dick is probably, that and Huckleberry Finn are probably the greatest works of American literature. At least that's what the academics say, and I would not dispute that. Of course, what you could have done if you were a little younger, going to Nantucket instead of reading the book, you could have gone to that garage theater where they show Gregory Peck as Captain Ahab in the movie version. You know, saved a lot of time.
You've been to Nantucket.
Yes. On rainy days, you either go to the Whaling Museum or to the garage where they show Moby Dick, and I must have seen Moby Dick five times. So.
They also have a silent version with the John Barrymore
as that
Ahab.
One.
Yeah. I've seen all Moby Dicks that Nantucket has to offer.
Well, your column, is how many times a week is the column?
It's three times a week. It appears twice in the Daily Times and once in the Sunday Magazine.
I was talking to a columnist for the Atlanta Constitution. His name is Louis Wizard. and he writes a daily column. Maybe it's 4 days a week, and he's been doing it for a couple of years. He always wanted to do a daily column. He was telling me that what a wonderful, wonderful thing to have a daily column. He says, it was like marrying a nymphomaniac, he said, when he first started writing this column. He said, the first 2 weeks was fun.
Yes, I've never heard that metaphor, but it's exactly right. It's exactly right. My column's in its 25th year. I mean, that's an old it's an old arthritic column. But I remember when I first got the column, what joy and excitement I felt. I thought, oh, boy, at last I have a newspaper column. Now I can discharge the entire content of my brain without interference. After three or four, five columns, I had discharged the entire content of my brain. And I suddenly, what do I do now? And I've got three more due next week, and the week after that, and next month, and next year. It just goes on and on and on. Yes, I like your friend's metaphor, Grizzard.
Well, the ideas never really stop, though. Somehow they come in. It's, of course, your column is a lot different. Who's this fellow who writes in the big columns in San Francisco? Herb Cain?
Herb Cain in San Francisco, yes.
Now, his column, I understand, is quite different. He uses little bits and pieces as he walks around to restaurants and things like that. It's not really set up to be a national column anyway. But that would be kind of easy, you know, have people feed you, press agents. I don't know if they still have press agents or not, but...
I don't know whether that's easy. He has to somehow package it so it's interesting to people. I think if I had to work the kind of material he does, people probably wouldn't read me. I don't have the gift of making that interesting to a journalistic audience. I don't know. I just don't know. But really, what happens with a column after a while is that it gets in your gland somehow. You know, at a certain time, you do the column. You've got to have one. You've done it. And you know you can do it again, even though you have nothing to say.
Well, you observe what's going on around you, and you comment on it. You are no longer living in New York, are you?
No, I live in Virginia now.
Outside of Washington.
Mm.
Of course, New York gave you a lot of stimuli, didn't it?
Yes, I find to change environment is always good for me, and I think it's good for most newspaper people to kind of get out of their ruts and go someplace new and have to rethink what they're doing. But I enjoyed New York. I really loved working in New York.
You really like the noise. I remember one column I think you were talking about, the explosions that sounded... You never knew where those... Didn't you write that column?
Yes,
where the explosions occurred, you never could... I still hear them. I live in Manhattan. And I've always wondered where these explosions... I mean, it's just a horrible boom. Mm-hmm. And I thought maybe they're... trucks that pass over manhole covers or big iron plates in the street, but I've never been able to identify the noise.
What always bothered me about them was that I'd hear them in the house, and I would run outside to see what had happened, expecting to find a smoking whole block of smoking ruins, and nothing had happened, and everybody was going around very, you know, people going about their business, and no excitement at all.
See, if you'd come from New York instead of Baltimore, you would have known that. You wouldn't have run outside. There's a new phenomenon, however. I live near a fire station. Now, living near a firehouse is not the most pleasant experience in the world, but in the last few years, there are these alarms, burglar alarms on automobiles.
Oh, yes, I know them.
Well, what happens? I've tried to figure out exactly what happens. I'm not quite sure, but I think I understand. A fire engine will leave the house with its siren blazing, and it will go down the street, and as it passes, somehow it kicks off the sirens, the burglar alarms in the cars. So after you hear the fire engine siren trail off, there is still a sound of a siren. It can go on all night. At first I thought it was maybe the vibrations of the fire truck, but that couldn't be because trucks can also go down Columbus Avenue and create a lot of vibration. So there must be something in the wavelength of the one siren touching off the other. So that should be a column for
them. They're in harmony. They're setting up a harmonic chord, I suppose. I remember that as being about the most unpleasant thing about New York, those car burglar alarms, which would, as you say, go on all night. And you could put up with almost any noise in New York except that, because it was unending. It would go on and on. It seemed to me that often they were touched off by other cars bumping them in parking. You know the way New Yorkers park.
By ear.
You get in there and you've got a 20-foot car and there's a 19-foot space, so you've got to make another foot of space and you nuzzle in and you bang the car in front and then you bang the one behind. When you get through, you ruin two transmissions and set off two burglar alarms and you walk away. That was my theory of what caused it.
Are you in a bucolic location in Virginia?
Reasonably. I live in a courthouse town. It was the kind of place where people ride around they chase foxes on horseback. It's an odd pastime.
Did you write the similar column when you were with the Baltimore Sun?
No, I was a reporter for the Baltimore Sun. I learned the trade on the Baltimore Sun. I did police reporting, I did general assignments, I did rewrite, I was London correspondent, and then I was White House correspondent at the Sun.
You have a marvelous story in Growing Up, in which you were, I believe it was in high school, and it was a male, it's been a while since I've read this, but it was an English teacher that you had who was a very straight-laced guy who was making assignments. And he assigned. Well, why don't you tell that story if you recall it? And this is really, I think, gave you the impetus to become a writer.
Well, it was my junior year in high school, and I had never been very good in English. I had no intention of making a career of writing. Of course, at that time, you couldn't make a career at writing. Even successful writers did something to make money, and. In the junior year, we were assigned to the dullest English teacher in the school, Mr. Flagel. And I groaned along under Mr. Flagel. English was always a terribly boring subject to me. And finally we came to the essay writing part of the year. And writing an essay. Nothing's duller than the essay. So he gave us a list of assignments in the book, I guess. I took it home and I put it off and put it off and put it off until the night before it was due, and I said, got to write something. I went down the list and nothing there that I was interested in. But I did, near the bottom was one thing, said, the art of eating spaghetti. And that reminded me of a time when I was a kid back in the Depression living in Jersey. And the first time we'd ever eaten spaghetti. Spaghetti was an exotic dish, and I remember the good feeling we all had sitting around the table joking about how to eat spaghetti. So I wrote this essay just for myself. Violated all the rules and knew it was going to fail, and I thought, what the heck? I'm having a good time writing, remembering this, and turned it in. And a couple days later, Mr. Flagel returned all the papers and all but mine. And I thought, oh boy. He didn't even give my paper back. It's really bad. I should have been more serious about that. And when he got all the papers redistributed, he took this one paper and he said, now, boys, I'm going to read you an essay. And he started reading my Art of Eating Spaghetti aloud to the class, and the class started to laugh. It was the most extraordinary feeling. Everybody in the room was responding to my words. The whole place was kind of moving. And, you could have floored me. And when he finished, he said, put it down, he said, now that, boys, is an essay. And I thought, hey, maybe I could be a writer. It was a wonderful feeling. And I, it gave me a way to think of myself. Very rare at that time.
It is interesting that in much the same way as an actor, a writer, can manipulate feelings and reach us and touch us in many ways. Of course, a writer also, like an actor, has to meet the critics occasionally and get lambasted or praised. So, in a way, acting and writing both are professions that reach out to people, and I guess they're linked in many respects, don't you think?
Well, acting is... So if you're a writer, I think you probably naturally are uneasy with actors. It's the other side of the coin. If you're writing, you're creating, you create something in your head, and you see it in your head in a way nobody else can possibly see it. And then an actor takes it, if its material is being acted, and he has seen something too, but what he sees is not what you see. And he does something that maybe offends what you see. And you hate him. You say, that's not the way it should be at all. I think that's what happens often between writers and actors. And not invariably. Jules Pfeiffer once told me, Jules Pfeiffer is very fond of actors, said he had never realized till he had his first play produced what an actor could do for a writer, you know, how much the actor improved what he thought he had written. So it works both ways, but when I write, I have images very clearly inside my head, and even to hear somebody else read what I write bothers me, because they're not reading it right.
Have you done any fiction? You've done no fiction yet.
When I was 24 years old, I wrote a novel. Yes, it was terrible. Robert Penn Warren had written All the King's Men the previous year, I think. And I had read it and been tremendously impressed. So I was teaching myself to type. I rented an old Royal typewriter. And after I learned the basic finger exercise, which is very simple when typing, I thought, well, I might as well do something more interesting than these exercises, so I'll write a novel. And I wrote a novel, which in the Robert Penn Warren, All the King's Men style. And it's just dreadful. Oh, it was awful. It took me about 4 months, 3 or 4 months. I shipped it out to various
publishers.
It was about a young man who was learning to type. It's like all 24-year-old novels. You know? It was an examination of my own naval lint. And I sent it out to some publishers who sent it back, and I kept it for years. When I moved from Washington in 1974, poking around in the attic of this big old house we had in Washington, I found the manuscript, and I was horrified that the thing still existed. I said, my good heavens, suppose somebody discovers this.
Well, why don't you resubmit it under the name Anonymous?
We destroyed it.
Well, Russell Baker, I hope that you're not too talked out. I appreciate your coming in to chat with me about the Norton Book of Light Verse. And I enjoyed... I guess I read... I don't read books of poetry right. You know... When you read growing up, for example, you start at page one and you go right to the end.
It's a page turner, as they say.
But when you read poetry, I can't do it that way. I tend to zip through, and if the first couple of lines don't attract me, I go on to another one, you know, until I find something.
But of course, that's the way you should read it.
Is that the way you're supposed to read
poetry? I think that's the way you should read it, yeah. Yeah, you shouldn't feel obliged to read anything unless you're getting paid for it. But when you're reading for pleasure, if it doesn't interest you, go on to the next thing, or put the book aside and go on to the next book. I think you have no obligation to read that poem. You know, your obligation is to enjoy what you're doing.
Well, I was talking to a columnist for the Houston Post, a former columnist, whose name momentarily escapes me. Somebody had sent me a column in which he... And I called him on the phone to do a little story about it. He always felt that in school they said that when you start reading a book, you're supposed to read it from the beginning to the end. And his parents put pressure on him. Now you start with Merchant of Venice and you finish it. So he would force his way through all of these books. Well, as he became older, he'd start to read, and he felt, well, you know, there's no teacher behind me. There are no parents to interfere. He said, I come to a... I start reading a book and it becomes boring, you know. Put a bookmark in it, just put it aside. And he was looking up at his bookshelf one day, and he saw all of these bookmarks sticking out of hundreds and hundreds of books that he never finished.
Poor guy.
And he felt no pangs of guilt. So he says, you know, he can go back to it, pick up where he left off someday if he feels in the mood. But now he doesn't feel any pangs of guilt if he doesn't go all the way through a book that he started to read.
Good for him. Yes, I mean, that's... After all, why did I organize this book in that fashion? So you didn't have to start at the beginning and go to the end. You can start anywhere.
There's some of us who just like the love verse.
Yeah, exactly. The bawdy stuff.
Dirty poems.
It's what the Monty Python calls the naughty bits.
Well, it was fun, really fun talking to you, Russell Baker, and I hope the ordeal back here in New York after your courthouse existence in Virginia wasn't too extreme and you didn't hear too many sirens.
No, I always love coming to New York. Great place. People out there don't believe me when I say New York is a great place. I love it.
I guess the only thing you really have to complain about now are the yelps of the foxes.
Yeah, well, I never get close enough to foxes, or horses, for that matter. I'm probably the world's most inept man with animals. Animals dislike me. They know something. I wish I knew what it was.
Well, if you're back in New York, you could ride down the elevator every day with one of several huge dogs who happen to populate my apartment house. And you can hardly wait to get down to the street and sometimes don't. Well, Russell Baker, thank you very, very much.
Thank you for having me.